Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows. Okay, that's kind of a weird way of starting the podcast, but it's a radio drama, which is going to be the topic of this week's podcast. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I'm Ken Levine, your podcast host. And like I said, I'm going to discuss something that I have never discussed on this podcast before, radio, or now audio drama. It is storytelling that really takes advantage of your imagination. Now, way back in the 30s and 40s, of course, radio dramas were the equivalent of primetime entertainment. It's kind of hard to imagine now, but back then, whole families would get together after dinner and sit around in the living room and just look at a radio. Well, for decades, radio drama has been a lost art, but now, with podcasting, there really is a resurgence, and there is a podcast series that is going to be dropping on Audible on June 16th called The Big Lie. It's a noir drama set in the 1950s with an all-star cast that includes John Hamm, Kate Mara, John Slattery, our friend Lisa Edelstein, Giancarlo Esposito, Gus from Breaking Bad, and others. So my guests today, actually there are two of them, are writer John Mankiewicz and director Aaron Lipstadt. Now, John's credits include House of Cards, Bosch, House, and he goes all the way back to Miami Vice and Hill Street Blues. And Aaron's directing credits include Bull, Bosch, Grimm, all shows with one-word titles. No, that's not true. Law and Order, Wise Guy, another one-word title. The Equalizer, The Good One with Edward Woodward, not the current one. And also Miami Vice. So they're going to talk about the making and challenges of a radio drama. Hey, you might want to put one together yourself. Okay, some background on the premise, and then I'm going to play you a sample of the show. Now, this actually stems from real life. In the early 1950s, there was a movie called Salt of the Earth that was done by blacklisted artists. They were Mike Wilson and Paul Jericho and a couple of others. Well, the government thought that it was subversive and tried to shut it down. John Hamm will play the FBI agent assigned to look into that. So now let's listen to a couple of minutes of The Big Lie.
Aloha. What can I get you, ma'am?
Coke, please. Actually, forget the Coke. What my husband really wants is a Johnny Walker Black.
Yes, ma'am.
Better make it a double. He's not a big John Wayne fan.
This is not the way to RKO.
Howard Hughes, full of surprises.
What, are you kidding me? Griffith Park?
Hey, what can I tell you? I wonder how your Cardinals are doing tonight.
Oh, boss, look out! Oh!
That was coming straight at us, with no headlights.
Sweet Jesus, you see the driver?
Yeah, I did.
The moon over Griffith Observatory is very nearly full now. Remember where you just saw the sunset? The moon is on the opposite side of the sky now. Why does the moon seem to change shape, as we have just observed?
Why is there a whole fucking bar set up in here?
And food. And why am I always starving?
Each month, and grew until it was full. And the second the moon achieved its perfect fullness, a giant pig attacked it and feasted on the moon until the end of the month. Until there was...
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm afraid Mr. Hughes had to leave just now.
Yeah, we just missed him.
Jack.
He should get those headlights fixed.
Or turn them on.
Or just learn to fucking drive.
Man says what he thinks. I like that. Noah Dietrich.
Jack Bergen.
Anyone hungry or thirsty?
What are these, steak sandwiches?
Tried tip, medium rare. Mr. Hughes thinks everyone likes what he does.
Well, he's right this time.
Jack, you did the cast and crew background for Angel Face, right?
Yes, sir.
This is an outstanding sandwich.
It was extremely good work. Straight. To the point.
Just doing my job.
May I take your picture, Jack? Mr. Hughes likes to know what his friends look like.
I usually meet someone before we become friends.
Jack, it's fine.
No, if you don't want to do it, it's all right.
Straight on or profile?
Just like that is fine. Thank you.
No problem. Do I get one of him?
They couldn't use language like that on the radio, even on the NBC Blue Network. Okay, so now that you've heard it, let's meet the creative team. Once again, this is writer John Mankiewicz and director Aaron Lipstad. So first of all, this is exciting, having two guests instead of one. Inflation, I guess.
That's right. It's twice as good.
Let's start out. John, this was a passion project of yours that you've been working on for, what, a couple of decades now?
Yes, and I think it's a passion project of both of ours at the same time. We met Paul Jericho, who made Salt of the Earth, who had this great story. Telling it, you know, it was a way to avoid it being sort of a message movie, you know, telling it from the point of view of the FBI guy who was following this production around.
How did you guys decide to make it as a podcast?
First of all, I think an important part of this is that Paul Jericho was going to write this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after we sold it, like within a week.
So originally you sold it as a screenplay that you were going to do this as a movie, okay?
Yeah, we were going to do it as a movie.
Both of us were under contract to Paramount. We had a deal with Paramount, and we brought them this idea that Paul was going to write, and they said, great, let's go ahead, let's proceed.
Okay, and then what?
Paul was in L.A. for what was in fact a Writers Guild 50th anniversary commemoration of the beginning of The Blacklist. And he, at that time, was living in Ojai, and on his, driving home from this Writers Guild commemoration, he was involved in a car accident, and he died.
Oh, man.
So at that point, Leah, his wife, and Aaron said, well, you'll write it now. Aaron and I were just going to produce it, along with Dan Pine, who was our partner at this company we had at Paramount, where you guys were at the same time, I think, mm-hmm. You and David. So I felt sort of a big responsibility writing it, but as I wrote it, I kind of became, I mean, I knew about The Blacklist. I mean, it was a horrible thing. But as I'm writing this, the idea that people could say, well, you're not allowed to write. You're not even allowed to try. Writing's hard enough you know, to think you know, to think you can support a family just by having ideas and selling them is insane. And for someone to tell you, well, you're not even allowed to try. As I was writing this, it just became more and more obscene and horrible that this happened. So I wrote it as a script. And I guess this was in the late 90s. And at that point, the studio who liked the script and was going to make it wanted me to hire a blacklisted director to sort of stunt casting as director.
Right.
And there were a few of those around, Marty Ritt. I'm trying to think who else they mentioned. And I thought, well, I could throw Aaron over on a lot of stuff, but maybe not a blacklist movie.
Scruples in Hollywood?
Well, yeah, it was.
What's that all about? Yeah. Are you nuts? What are you talking about?
I know. Aaron and I talked about it at the time. It was pretty funny. So we continued. We kept trying to make it, and a couple of times over the years, you know, we got close. And then when Audible came to me at the beginning of COVID, you know, I thought about, you know, it's a period thing. They're talking about 4.5 hours of material, just audio. I'd actually been listening to, because, you know, it was COVID, nothing to do. I've been listening to like these Beckett plays, you know, they did for the BBC. And basically, I thought podcast could be another word for radio play. So I called Aaron and, you know, we decided to put it together. We had John Hamm interested at one point in the movie, and Aaron called him and he said he was in. And once John was in it, Aaron, I don't know if you feel this way, but it was just like everything fell together.
10 days between waiting to hear from John was probably the most stressful of the whole project, because we knew that you know, if John were willing to do it, it would make it a lot more easy for it to get to pass through the portals of Audible. And also, it's a lot easier to go to actors and saying, would you be in this? You know, it involves, you know, a day of work or a couple of days of work, and John Hamm is the lead, and it gives you this kind of credibility that, you know, I had never done anything like this before, and John never done anything like this before, so that made it a lot easier.
Now, during the COVID period, I had a number of readings of my plays, and because a lot of actors who normally would not be available were just sitting home doing nothing, I was able to get some big-name guys to do readings of my play, but it was just a reading of my play for fun. I didn't pay anybody. Did any of these actors, it's like, you know, what is their price for Audible? Did they want to be paid?
Well, everybody got paid the SAG rate for recording, which is not very much money, and especially for
$15 a week.
Well, it was basically car money. You know, I'd say that the biggest hurdle after getting John involved, John Hamm, that is, was what I didn't want to do is record a lot of people sitting in their living rooms or closets, wherever they would be. I thought it was really important for the performances and for the relationships in the movie, in the podcast, to have them together, have them in the same room. And of course, it was the middle of COVID, and you know, the production company that was funding this was not prepared for getting to a studio with actors. But that's what we did. So that was the hardest thing: is getting John Hamm and Kate Mara and Brad Whitford and Lisa Edelstein and Kirk Balz into a studio so they could do their scenes together. And there's no doubt in my mind that no matter how hard that might have been, it was definitely worth it to see them working together and to, you know, make adjustments in performance so that one actor would play off the other was invaluable. So yeah, they got paid basically nothing, and did come to a studio in Hollywood and brave COVID by working behind plastic partitions.
Yeah.
But I know all of them.
When I recorded a Simpsons episode, and it was just so valuable to have all of the actors standing around in a circle with their music stands and all just playing off of each other, as opposed to, I know, a number of animated movies where they'll bring in somebody and record his whole part, and then they'll bring in somebody else and record their part. And I just don't know, as an actor, how you can really perform, how you really can relate to other people when you do that. So I imagine the performances have to be so far superior to had you just done it individually.
And even now, and maybe I shouldn't say so, but there are a couple of people who did record remotely, and there's no question in my mind that if we had them in the studio, it would have been better. You know, the only other way to do that is to actually cut somebody's dialogue so that one actor is recorded to another recorded dialogue, you know, the recorded dialogue of an actor, but that was really beyond our capability at that time. But yeah, I think actors, you know, they work best when they can riff off somebody else. And I think that's, if there's value to the performance in this, which I really think there is, then that's why it is, because they were each working together.
Okay. And John, you weren't thinking of getting Martin Ritt to direct this instead of Aaron, right? You're going to let Aaron direct this?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. You did the writing.
Marty was immunocompromised.
You did the writing. And it seems to me that writing for audio, radio, is very different in the sense that, you look back, say, at those old radio dramas and like the old Superman shows where he would have to go up, up and away, because you needed to tell the audience that I'm flying now. And you probably encountered a number of times when something that you could easily show visually, now you have to convey through audio, and how you do that in dialogue and still make it sound natural and not just, well, I'm going to put some more Splenda in my tea now. that had to be a challenge.
A huge challenge and a very steep learning curve. And I'm here to say that, you know, a picture might be worth more than 1,000 words. You know, because we, as writers, I come from the show not tell school, and you have to think of locations that are sort of audio dependent. Like there's a scene in the first episode that takes place at the planetarium that I don't think would take place, where he meets Howard Hughes at a planetarium, that I don't think would have taken place at a planetarium in a movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have the freedom to do that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But you have to be able to, distinguish settings, and, you know, there are some shorthand things that we figured out along the way, which is we had Ham read FBI reports to say what was going on, and by burying them in the reports, hoping that there was a little bit of tension in the fact that they were FBI reports and he was reporting to his boss, and here's what's happening in the movie or in the podcast. It was a good device.
Did you do a lot of rewriting during recording? It's like you're hearing it for the first time. Normally you get a chance to do a lot of rehearsal. When you're hearing it, you're going, oh, that might be a little clunky. Why don't we try this? So was there a lot of adjustments during the recording session?
Yeah, there was. The sound people we were working with expected, you know, we had a read through in the beginning of all 7 episodes, and they said, okay, the script's locked now, right? And Aaron and I looked at each other by Zoom and said, well, you could say that, but we're going to be changing a whole lot.
Well, it was very interesting, because the, I don't know what you want to call it, let's call it the production company. There was a very talented and capable crew of guys who had done what I would call a more, maybe a less ambitious series of podcasts before. And they had a way that, you know, they were planning to do this. And I guess we in our naivete didn't realize how far from that norm we were going. I mean, we had over 150 speaking parts in this thing. We had multiple locations. It's period, so the cars are period, and the phones are period, and everything's got to be a little more specific. So what they had, I gather, normally done is they do a read through for timing with anybody just to get hear what it sounds like. And when they said we'll have a read through, we of course said, great. So we got a cast, and some of whom were in the final product, and many, many of whom were just as a favor, get on Zoom and record the whole thing, you know, 4.5 hours of it. Part of it was to try out some actors, but mostly it was so John and I and Jamie could hear the thing in its entirety. Mm-hmm. See if it made any sense. See if you could, you know, you knew where you were, you knew what was happening. And obviously had the opportunity to do a lot of what we thought were sort of necessary fixes, which they were prepared to really take what we had recorded and say, okay, now we're timed. We're going to start cutting backgrounds. But it wasn't a major problem. It was just a little bit of recalibrating expectations.
Now, I've seen a lot of reenactments of the old radio dramas, and it was always fun to see the guy off to the side with the coconut shells that were doubled for horse hoofs and things like that, and how they had to ingeniously find ways of making all of these sounds. Probably the funniest Frasier episode ever is Ham Radio, where they do that just as a as a sidelight. But you guys had the advantage in the digital age of all the sound effects you wanted, processed any way you wanted. So I imagine that you were really able to take advantage of that. And so that really every moment of your plays sounds full and has the exact sounds that you want.
Well, there's two different things. One is, you know, you alluded to earlier, which is, you know, when John wrote this, there are sequences where there wasn't dialogue, that was very visual, that things were communicated without dialogue. And that was a great challenge to imagine directing that movie. Mm-hmm. But when it came to this, we both had to really try and think very hard about how is this going to sound? What are we going to know? We didn't want to do what you were saying. Oh, Jim, I see you're wearing that blue suit again today. You know, we didn't want to, we wanted to have the dialogue sound like dialogue. The FBI reports were a big help, but you still wanted, you know, you didn't want to have to lead people by the nose and say things that, you know, obviously people wouldn't say. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, we both were listening to a lot of stuff to try and understand what the precedents were. And it's kind of amazing how much, if the audience is invested in the character and the performance, they will go with the story. And if you listen to old, even from the 30s, radio drama, the sound effects, as you kind of alluded to, you know, the two coconuts, they would make a picture in your head of a location, whether it was, you know, the sound of the wind or the horse hooves or something.
Right. And use your imagination.
You would go with it. So I would say in retrospect, a lot of our fears were a little bit extreme because the performance is really take the story where you want it to go. But the other thing that was fun was to do things with sound that were very specific to telling a story. Like, one thing I know I wanted very early on was the sound of Jack's Zippo lighter. Even when he's alone, you hear that lighter flicking open. You hear the splint on the wheel. You hear him taking a puff. You know exactly what's going on. And that becomes the kind of signature that, you know, it wouldn't really make as much sense to do in a movie. But in something like this is really, you know, something that you can have fun with and get into character in ways that, you know, you wouldn't have thought of otherwise.
I'm trying to think of how you do that with the coconut shells. But how long did it take you to put together the final product once you had recorded it, putting in all the sound effects and music? Because that's something else we should talk about, because you have a Grammy-winning composer who put together like a different theme composition for every episode, correct?
Yes. And also the music, I think, was very helpful in terms of conveying mood and, you know, moving the story along. And as you mentioned, you know, a different variation on the theme for each episode was just like deluxe and, you know, so great to have. And Mansfield was so sensitive to the material. We also had, you know, the airplanes buzzing the set of the movie. I don't know that you can do that with coconuts. You know, we had real airplanes and we, you know, panning right to left, and sound has progressed tremendously.
How long did it take you then, you recorded all of the actors, to finally cobble together the final product?
Beginning of June, and we delivered in the end of November. definitely had a locked script.
The script was never quite locked. And I have to say that I wrote it with Jamie Napoli, who I worked with on my last TV show, in, you know, expanding this to, you know, to 4.5 hours, who was fantastic.
So there are 7 episodes, and are they all dropping at the same time, or are they being doled out week to week, kind of like an HBO Max type of thing?
It's all at once.
Audible is basically on a Netflix model, where you pay a monthly subscription and you listen to as much as you want. And yeah, they drop the show all at once. And the idea is that you're going to just get in your car and drive until you finish it. So if you're in LA and you get to Phoenix, then you can stop.
Yeah. Well, I also thought they say they're going to debut it at the Tribeca Festival. And I thought, well, what are they going to give people? Cars to drive.
Yeah, you're just going to sit in a room and listen.
Teslas, you know.
Well, congratulations. It sounds like a really fun project. I heard a preview of it, and it was really, really good. And for me, it was kind of like a throwback to those great old radio dramas. And from time to time, you know, on Sirius XM, if I'm driving around looking for something to listen to, I'll listen to, you know, one of those old radio dramas. And it's fun, and it is engrossing, and you do get into the characters, and you got an amazing cast and just great writers, great directing. So it's going to be huge. Of course, what does that even mean?
Right? Well, someone recently said, you know, have you ever thought about doing a movie of this? And there's some talk of maybe doing a second season.
The Making of Volunteers should be part two.
That's right.
I think you could do way more than 4.5 hours on the Making of Volunteers.
Just with Tom and Rita.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We were not loved by the Peace Corps. Anyway, good luck with it, guys. Hard to believe I'm plugging another podcast competition, but it's a great show. So I certainly recommend it.
If there is a part two or a sequel to this, we'll make sure that Jack plugs your podcast on the air.
I would sure appreciate that. Thanks much. Thanks, guys. I hope you found that interesting. Writer John Mankiewicz and director Aaron Lipstadt. And again, it is called The Big Lie, and it is available on Audible. So that will do it for this edition of Hollywood and Levine. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com is my email address, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I'm on Twitter, @KenLevine. I'm on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Thanks so much for listening, and we will join you again next week right here on
Hollywood and Levine.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.